This is Geek Speak, episode 46 of season 16. Hi, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well. What's our first story of the day, sir?
The Internet Archive, archive.org.
That's a wonderful site.
It's a site that, if you've ever had a website up on the internet, let's say you had one back in the year 1998, they would have a copy of it. They would show you what it looked like at that time. You can go back and in what they call their Wayback Machine. They are celebrating their 20th anniversary. So they began in 1996.
Cool.
Back in the cradle of the web.
Do you have a website up before then?
I might have had a site go up just at the beginning of 96, but it might have just made the cut and hit 95.
And of course, the Internet Archive has a lot of data, but the Wayback Machine is the one that you and I have always used for years.
Yep, and it's a lot of data, and it is possible to turn it on, like set your robots.txt file so that they don't crawl it. But who would want to do that? Because of the database work I've been doing on GeekSpeak, I've been looking at the Wayback Machine to see if I can find out, like, what's the title of these old shows? What was
Absolutely.
Some information that was on there? What are the news stories that were associated with it?
So October 30th, 1996 was the first time my personal website went online. It wasn't
that they have.
Yeah. In fact, of course, it was a little bit earlier than that, but it wasn't one that I currently own anymore. It was actually at bigtimetv.com. But there's a horrible animated GIF. Look at this thing. That's awesome. A whole bunch of animated GIFs that I made by hand.
That looks like straight out of GeoCities.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'll have to link to that at the show. Okay, cool. Happy birthday, Internet Archive. Let's also talk about this Facebook story, just because it's fresh in my mind.
There's been a fresh write-up of Facebook allowing advertisers to exclude users by their ethnicity.
We covered a story like this in March. In fact, you covered a story like this in March when this advertising filtering system first came online.
Right.
That they were – it wasn't race-based. It was race affinity based or ethnic affinity,
right?
To get away from the word race. But of course, we're talking about race,
right? It was, and at the time, we were talking about the movie that had just come out, Straight Outta Compton, and how the way that it was being presented to Facebook users was different depending upon your ethnic affinity,
right?
If your ethnic affinity was white, it talked about the origins of Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, versus otherwise. It assumed that you were more likely to know who NWA was,
right,
who the story was about. At that time, it just seemed like, huh, that's interesting. This dual view and talk about the pros and cons of it. But there is a bit of a darker turn to this that people were pointing out recently. There was an example made by a journalist that said, for example, with newspapers, it was quite often to have ads for housing.
Yeah,
and
of course.
One of the laws that was passed back in the day was the Fair Housing Act, which said that you are not allowed to say, hey, have this apartment open, whites only, or no Mexicans. That type of thing was flatly illegal. And newspapers actually would follow through, and they would deny any ads that had something like that. On Facebook, however, right now, you could go in and say, I want to find detail targeting to go to residential profiles, people who are likely to move, buy a house, first-time buyer, who are house hunting. You know, so you're looking for someone who would want to look for a place to stay, a place to live. Let's say you're a real estate agent. That would be a very likely target to go for. But you can narrow your audience based upon several criteria. And that can be expected income or something like that. But where it really gets sketchy is you can do it on demographics and specifically ethnic affinity. To say, I want to show an ad about to people that are looking to buy a house, but I want to exclude people who are found to be African American, Asian American, or Hispanic based upon the algorithms of Facebook to see where you would fit in, which box you would fit into.
Right.
That in and of itself, that action is illegal by federal law. So it's a question of they're not actually putting up the ad, so is Facebook liable? And so there's been this back and forth about whether or not Facebook is liable for this or not. And it brought up a discussion for me when I was online on Twitter in the 140-character back and forth that you have with folks, which was, if you have the ability to exclude by ethnicity, what responsibility do you have as a tech organization, some portal, to police that in some way?
Mm-hmm.
Not so much does Facebook have an obvious legal liability. I don't know that they do. There's an argument for it, but I don't know that they do.
Well, I guess the same question could be done in a standard form. If you had a newspaper and the newspaper had classified areas, and when the person filled out the form in the classified areas, they put down that, you know, we're interested in housing, I'm renting a house, mm-hmm. and in that they wrote text to the case of, you know, whites only. Right.
Right. The newspaper is bound by law to go, nope, that's not allowed.
So wait, so the newspaper is bound by law not to print
yes.
that? So they have to look through their paper and decide what is viable, legally viable, and what is not legally
yes.
viable. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Although newspapers, from what journalists have been saying in the aftermath of this story, was that there weren't that many people actually going to newspapers doing that anymore. Like, people kind of got the hint.
Yeah,
40 years ago when the laws were passed. But now it's showing up again with Facebook. These are issues that, you know, the programmers of Facebook are in general fairly young. The tech industry is fairly young. They probably never even thought that this might be – it never occurred to them that this might be a problem, I think,
right.
in a lot of
yeah,
cases.
I agree with you to some level. I think that also, though, if you were to say, okay, the system that we're doing, which is trying to filter in all things, we have to make sure we always abide by the laws. That'll be very hard to do because, of course, they're a global company. There are counties where they don't know what the laws are. So you theoretically could have – you could break a rule all the time anyway.
Doing
right?
jurisdictions is one thing and at that fine-grained control. But we're talking about a federal law, which
yep.
would affect all of the U.S. where –
that's a lot of people.
Most of the programs I'm aware of for Facebook are in the U.S.
No, I grant that. But keep in mind that they know they won't be able to abide by every law that they're in every region they're in. They just won't be able to do that. So therefore, what do? You do your best to abide by the laws you know about. You take advantage of the knowledge of your programmers, and you implement the best you can. Or you say, you know what? We're going to do no filtering. The individual's responsible.
I disagree with that. For example, when I think of Google and Google Maps, if you look at Google Maps, you would think like, well, they have made these decisions about what it's going to be. And you might think that all they do is for other countries, they change the labels to be in Chinese or Mandarin or in Russian or English. And that's not what they do.
What do they do?
If you are in India, the map for the Kashmir region looks different than if you are in Pakistan.
Why?
The map is actually different because it is illegal to show the Kashmir region as being
right.
not part of India there.
Right.
And here in the U.S., Kashmir region is shown as an area in dispute.
And to be fair, access in a country, the rules that you abide by are at some level. Civil liberty rules, when you talk about information passing, is less of an impact for the country. Right? Like
right.
whether Pakistan wants the border to say a certain thing or not is extremely important for their whole political structure to exist. But whether people are being subjugated under their rule is not so important. So I can kind of understand why some rules are going to be abided by
well,
when some
if
aren't.
You're a company that's doing business in those countries,
you have to abide by the rules. Yeah.
Right. But that's what we're talking about advertising here, which means that someone in that country has to be buying it. Once you get to that threshold where money is changing hands, it's no longer just you're putting up a website and whoever happens to access it.
Okay,
it's
so
now the commerce having to do with that and the market having to do with that country.
Just
that
to confirm, I've advertised on Facebook before for GeekSpeak to promote the show, and so I know the interface, and since I have an account, I was able to just create an ad right now. Now, I'm not doing advertising for getting clicks to my website, which is the generic
sure.
one, right? And in this situation, I can do a whole bunch of stuff in the beginning, which is the audience. So I've named an audience, and I did this before, called Central Coast. These are people that actually are local. I set this group up when we were doing an event in Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is, I'm including location. Everyone in this location, and I included a whole bunch of towns of Santa Cruz. And then I did the age range of 18 and all the way up to the max, which they have 65 plus. And I did 18 and above because I don't feel like advertising to kids makes a lot of sense. 18 might be the starting age, I'm not sure. Gender, I could choose male or female or all. I did all. They don't have other options besides mm-hmm. male or female at all. And then languages I didn't specify. And then includes, just for us playing with this figuring this out, I want to see what I could do. And I can add in interests, and I can exclude interests. So in the interest where I'm adding in interests, I have chosen to add additional interest, Caucasian race, people who have expressed an interest in or pages related to Caucasian race. Now, that's 604,000 people in this region, if you will. So it's a pretty broad. It's not like people are going, oh, I'm going to go take a look at Caucasian race websites. They're classifying that as some meaning, I think, but maybe not. If I remove that, well, I won't remove that. Then under exclude, there's a term called black culture. And this one is, there's 177 million people in this group. And it's additional interest, black culture. People who have expressed an interest in or like pages related to black culture. So if I try to exclude white culture and I start typing white culture, I get white night festivities. I don't know, it must be Christmas time or something. Mm-hmm. Cultural and reaction, and arts and culture. There is no white culture. So Caucasian race I was able to find. So I theoretically could include black culture and exclude Caucasian race. That's the closest I can do.
But you weren't also hitting demographics. This is where this reporter had found was demographics, ethnic affinity.
So let me see if they still have that.
And so there's the question of, is white in there? Because if all they have is African-American, Asian-American, Hispanic,
So when I type ethnic affinity, they have Hispanic, African-American, Hispanic bilingual, Hispanic Spanish dominant, Asian-American, Hispanic U.S. English dominant.
Where's white?
That's it. Where's
European-American?
That's all you got. Those are the ones they have specified and available. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
So this is treating white as the default.
This ethnic affinity is something more ambiguous than interested in certain things that are culturally relevant to blacks. I mean, I don't know how you say, and you know, I don't know what the difference is between the earlier one that I did, which was black culture websites. But here's the description they have. We'll go ahead and do the African American U.S. Ethnic affinity, African-American U.S., people who live in the United States whose activity on Facebook aligns with African-American ethnic affinity.
In other words, we think they're black. Yeah,
we think these people are black. Well, so you can't exclude white. That's weird. And you can't include white.
It's not
and
weird.
And of course, by the way, you can
it's
use
what
this,
happens.
You can use this ethnic affinity in include and exclude. So you could do it either way. Interesting. You can also report this as inappropriate. Should I report it as inappropriate?
My
account will get reclassified
as troublemaker. Yeah.
Yeah, something else. Maybe there's a troublemaker area. Fascinating. Well, since we have so many stories, we have to move on.
Right, but just to cover, this is very much like when you talk about literature. This is this was my major back in college, and this was a topic of a lot of conversation. Where you would say there's African American literature and there's Native American literature and there's stuff like that and Asian American literature, and then there was literature,
right? Literature and then other.
It's
literature.
It's like what's literature? Well, that's Shakespeare and.
you mean Western European literature is what you're trying to say,
right?
Right,
but. That just becomes the default. And I think that feels very much to me that's what's happened here with Facebook.
Obviously, yeah.
And that's where diversity within the tech ranks, I think, could help out a lot.
Well, so this case where somebody actually was able to post an illegal ad. Because I think here's another question that's interesting. If I had two magazines in an area, okay, we have a population of black people and white people, and I have two magazines, and one of the magazines always featured black people on the cover, and one of the magazines always featured white people on the covers. Mm-hmm. The stories were the same content in them completely, except for the names of things had changed. But that's basically it.
Uh-huh.
Two newspapers, and one will call Black Times, one will call White Times, okay,
for
this story. If I then come to this company, they own both these magazines, and I say, I'd like to advertise in there, and I'd like to advertise for an apartment in the classifieds area, and I just want to advertise in your White Times magazine. In that situation, am I breaking a law?
I don't believe that you are.
Because that could be Facebook's argument here. We're not telling you who you can have come into the apartment or not. We're just advertising based off of regions. But those two magazines are clearly the same thing Facebook does, right?
Except I can follow that logic. And this goes back to what I was saying earlier, whereas I don't think that Facebook is necessarily legally liable. I don't.
Right.
But I do think that they may be morally liable.
That's awesome. Yes. No, I think that they are. I think that, well, first off, considering they have such a giant monopoly on this kind of system, why not be morally justified in what you do? It's not like you have a competitor that's going to steal away your ads, right? I mean, they are it and Google, right?
Well, just so, I'm not going to talk much about it. Facebook has been kind of a cesspool with regard to our electoral process.
Yeah.
And I think that Facebook needs to step up and start doing a lot more things proactively to improve the signal.
Miles, that's a really tricky thing to do.
The thing is, I remember I'm harking back to Google again. There was a lot of stuff going on with regard to vaccines and whether or not they caused autism, which they don't.
Right. And Facebook and Google made that whole fact sheet.
Right. And Google went like, you know what? Just because the number of links people pointing to it does not make something factual. In fact, if it's non-factual, that hurts Google's reason for being. Google's idea was take the knowledge of the world and make it easily accessible to the greatest
number
of people.
And so they changed their algorithms to actually benefit search results that had factual information that was actually true facts.
Right.
And they used that true fact term by what they looked at.
Right.
And theoretically, they did the best they could to come up with scientifically more viable truths.
Right.
Okay.
Now, I'm not talking about taking away something because it's distasteful. That's a different argument.
But I have to say that when you talk about the cesspool that Facebook allows people to live in with regards to the content that they're immersed in on their feeds, to some degree, that is by the individual's choice to be in that space to communicate. But more than that, if Facebook's goal specifically is to be a profitable company, and that's their only responsibility, then I in some ways I'm like, well, then that's what they're doing. Google made the choice to actually have factual information be more important, even though they might get people to stay online and make more money if they don't do that. So they clearly made an ethical choice. And that might be because of the backbone of Google's desire to be non-evil.
Yes, but I think we think of it wrong when we give companies a free pass saying, well, their point is to make money, ethical concerns be damned. I think that is a very dangerous place
okay.
to live.
And I counter with, at least I know where they're coming from. If you say, hey, Facebook, you got to be right. You got to be doing things good. You got to decide a moral, ethical decision. Well, first off, a company can't be ethical and moral. It's not a human being. It's an entity that exists outside the ethical rules. And so if you then say you have to be good in some way, then you have to decide what that pattern is. And what if they now just say, okay, what we're going to do is, you know, people that clearly are more intelligent, we're going to make sure that they go vote. And people that aren't as intelligent, we make sure they don't go vote. That would be good for society potentially if they made that decision.
See, I'm going to disagree on that
one.
Talking about a pure factual basis. I'm not even talking about the, well, this was mostly false but it had a nugget of truth. I'm talking about the liar, liar, pants on fire
posts.
Completely racist tripe that came through the pipe. That people
would like to see Facebook start to modify that and start flagging things, some kind of them helping for people to understand what truth is?
What I mean is something akin to the American for Disabilities Act, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Because a company's bottom line may not be dependent upon whether or not their building has wheelchair access.
Right.
But we feel that as a society, it is ethical, it is the moral thing to do to allow access to all of our citizens,
okay.
not just the ones who are
okay.
able-bodied.
Great. So to some degree, I think the American Disability Act is a great example. It's a perfect example. So what is your intellectual knowledge information transfer rule set that you'd want to implement for Facebook? What kind of rule or law would you want to legislate for Facebook to follow that would actually help alleviate the cesspool that they've created? how would you do it?
You know, just off the bat, yes, it would be gamed. Uh-huh. But right off the bat, if you said if this has information that can be factually checked, it's not just, you know, someone is horrible or someone is great, but actual factual information. And you get all that factual information and none of it actually checks out.
Okay. But that the problem is you're talking about natural language processing now. How do you do that? I mean, you're right that Facebook has – I mean that Google has done that to some degree. But you have to understand that deciding what is relevant and what's not relevant for algorithms is not
but
easy.
But the amount of variation – we are not unique snowflakes. The amount of variation with a lot of these stories is not as high as you might think.
Okay. So you write a post that is completely tongue-in-cheek. So you make an article about how perfect Trump is. And in that, you're clearly being sarcastic. It's – from my read of it, it is completely sarcasm.
Okay, that's fair.
And
that's
you
fair.
Post all this crap that's obviously not true, and Facebook just says, nope. Well, wait a second.
That's fair. Satire
How do you
is
do
a
it?
Hard problem.
There are hard problems in this space that I don't – right now I know they do nothing. And at some level, that means the people involved in the communication are the crappy people. And I agree that what they are doing, though, is paying some people to post stuff because they're technically selling ads for the posts. And so if the posts are
– actually, as what it came out was a bunch of teenagers in Macedonia putting up a bunch of stores and random inflammatory stories. Did you hear about
no,
this?
I hadn't
heard this one. So a lot of wears a lot of T-shirts, hats, and other – but I mean not just the Make America Great Again, but I mean really inflammatory items – were coming out of a small group of folks in Macedonia that they don't really care who wins the U.S. election, but they know that that's going to be a really good market.
Right. So they're selling stuff in that market. Sure.
And coming up with stories, with really inflammatory stories.
Oh, to sell ads.
Yeah. To pump up the feedback.
So we obviously have a problem here, but as sarcasm is a perfect example, it's a really hard problem to solve. I agree that Facebook should be doing something about it. I'm hoping that they do. And at the same time, once they start doing that, it can't be opaque. It needs to be clear how they're doing that rule set,
sure.
Even if that helps people game the system. Because if you go into a situation where information
sure.
is altered on the fly and there's decisions being made, you don't know what truth is anymore either. They might get something wrong. They might say that a fact is not a fact, right? And then all of a sudden there's a serious problem.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I was trying to make that bar really low.
Yeah.
Just the things that are absolute, complete, utter horse crap.
So, Miles, you ever use your phone to navigate in your car?
Sure.
Okay. And you also, I'm assuming, make phone calls in your car, and also sometimes you will navigation, phone calls, music, listen to music.
Yes.
Okay. The issue with our phones right now, you and I both use iOS devices, is that as you use the phone, you switch between apps. And these apps are designed to be used while holding them and focusing on them. In the car, they become less designed for car usage, meaning there really should be like three buttons on your phone, a button that says maps, a button that says make a phone call.
It's funny that you should mention this because my use case actually is I turn on the phone, I go to the map, whether it be Google Maps or Waze.
For sure.
I put in my destination and set that up.
And then so you start your car.
And then I go into the music at like Pandora, although my van has integration
yeah, yeah.
with it. And that's when I get going. And so I never have to touch the phone again.
Right.
It's playing the music, and then the music is interrupted
by
turn by turn directions or a phone call.
And we also have the benefit of living in an environment where we're not on the freeway a lot. And so pulling over is extremely easy to do. On Highway 9, for example.
Wait, what? We live right next to Highway 17. What are you talking
about?
Yeah,
we're on Highway 17. But all the on and offs – I mean, in some parts of the country, the exits of the freeway and getting on and off the freeway could be a five-minute process. In the environment that I'm normally driving in, that I want to make a stop or have a phone call or text a message or whatever, there is ample times to pull over, getting completely out of traffic, be off the side of the road,
mm-hmm.
and get back on without losing much time at all. It's just getting in and out of traffic. It's not like I've got to do a large turn or go four blocks or anything like that. It's really easy to pull over. That's a benefit of our environment that allows me to, if I feel like texting somebody, I just pull over, take 5 minutes, text, and get back on the road. Like that's how I do it.
Okay.
But in any case, the in-car dash systems are normally designed pretty well, right? Like being able to turn skip music on your in your car is probably a button on your dashboard on your
steering wheel.
Wheel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a paddle. Yeah,
when you plug in the USB. In any case,
Bluetooth. Yeah,
yeah.
Plug in what?
Android. Google has made an Android car interface for quite a while. Where you, if you have a newer car, you can actually have Android software running in your car. Mm-hmm. And it connects to your device, your phone, so it syncs up to that. And then your phone, of course, is the GPS system and all those things. Your car doesn't actually have to have a cell service or anything. Well, Google just opened the Android app to all users, whether they have Android car in, they have their car enabled for Android car or not. So now if you have an Android device, you can get in your car, any kind of car, and open up the app, and then the your Android device locks down to this feature set that's appropriate for driving, your music, your navigation, your calls, and larger buttons to do this all in one app. You don't have to switch around as much, and it's a pretty cool interface. So if you've got an Android device, I highly recommend trying this out.
Yeah, try it out while your car isn't moving.
Of course.
And then see how that works out.
And then, of course, when this is open, you can use voice commands. And, of course, that's what I've actually started doing if I ever want to do other things while I'm driving is use voice commands. But I have to say it's much more convenient to ask my children who are in the car with me to grab my phone and do things for me. Anyways, don't drive and text.
Don't drive and hold your phone. I see so many people do that, too. They're driving along and they have their phone. They're holding it up.
Not worth it.
Yeah, it's an accident waiting to happen.
Okay, what's up with the Mira botnet? We've got a couple stories here. First one.
Mirabot, which is the Internet of Things botnet that took down the website for Brian Krebs, security researcher, took down Akamai. Well, it's back, and it has taken the African nation of Liberia off the air.
A whole country.
Right. And apparently Liberia only has a single fiber connection going out, but still, it's a nice big fat fiber connection. The attack that took down Brian Krebs' site and took down Akamai mm-hmm. was only about half the size of this one going after Liberia.
Interesting. All right. Well, same type of story in some sense. A denial of service attack recently hit two apartment buildings in Finland, in the eastern part of Finland. And these apartment buildings, of course, Finland's relatively cold this time of year. The environmental control systems for these two apartment buildings were online.
Oh, I see how where this is going.
A denial of service attack hit, and the company that was running it, Valteria, who's running the facilities for this for these buildings, have the software set up such that if network traffic persists in some way, the system restarts. So, unfortunately, the system heating and hot water control system for the building was controlled by the system that was routinely restarting, which means it wasn't functioning. And the staff, the maintenance staff that were going to repair the system have no idea what the network is doing. That is a mystery to them. They're not network engineers. They're heating and cooling system engineers.
Sure.
So the buildings were offline. This is exactly the kind of concern that Chester Winsky at Sophos Labs was concerned about taking facilities off land. Because, of course, you can't live in a building in an ice environment where the heating is off. So it's extremely dangerous. In November, the minus 25 degrees will occur most of the time. So they had to relocate the people that lived in the address and bring them in, then pull in a secondary system that bring in to heat the building. Or I should say they pulled the people out of the building, put them somewhere else, and then came in and worked on the problem until it was heated again. So that's how they had to solve it. Why is the heating system even on a public IP address? Like, why does it matter that it can't access the internet? That's the thing that's so frustrating to me. And the articles, of course, don't go into this.
This was our complaint about Internet of Things. Like, it's a gold rush. People were like, hey, we want to get out there. We want to have these things, like every little thing, like a, you know, climate control on the internet. And there wasn't enough thought given to what are all the potential drawbacks, because it just wasn't out there. It's like all of the exploits that came with a web browser come in the late 90s, because people – it just wasn't a problem that people had to deal with before. And you had the choice of, well, do I get out there and get my product out there and make a boatload of money, or do I become more cautious and then get left out?
I get that idea. And, I mean, buildings have been run by network-controlled computers for quite a long time. A large apartment – I mean, a a large building, you basically have to pump air through it all the time, or it becomes unlivable because they're so well sealed from temperature controls from inside and outside that you CO2 have to get oxygen.
You have to
circulate it. So the system being online is part of the health of the building. And so in that regard, it is equivalent to the fire suppression system functioning or not. So it is a high need situation. And a fire suppression system, you can't disable easily. It's not like it's like, oh, well, I forgot to turn on this morning. It is set to be on all the time, right?
Right.
Just like the backup
lights. And hopefully
lights.
Not internet capable where it can suffer from a denial of service attack. That's the other thing is, if you have something that's on the internet, you need to have a proper failure mode.
Right. Well, that's the thing is the failure mode of the network card not working is the network doesn't work anymore. The building should still be able to operate. It should keep going the way it was. Now, you could say that without the control flow that is being the brains that's being given by the company that's managing it, the system could get too hot one day or too cold one day, which is fine. But it seems to me that what you do if the network fails is you have a system that goes and says, okay, the building's going to be 65.
Right.
You know, that's just what it's
going to
do.
Yeah, the network connection went down. We now need to go back to standard thermostat control.
At the same time, I think the building's complexity is grand. You know, it's larger than you'd think it is.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, the ending of this article, it's in Forbes, and I'll link to it, of course, from geekspeak.org. So I'll read the last paragraph. Something about this attack feels like a one launched on Liberian mobile provider last week. Was someone probing a relatively small system in a relatively remote location just to test capabilities? It's a strong possibility. The end game might be a much larger building managed by a company with much deeper pockets, and perhaps one willing to pay attackers to call off the dogs. So if you targeted a building or multiple buildings in a city, you could create quite a serious problem in the middle of winter. Imagine New York and just hitting 30 apartment buildings that are managed by the same company and taking them offline. We're talking about, tens of thousands of people that need a place to live all of a sudden, and a company that theoretically is responsible for that. And blackmailing them's one thing, but making it be in a situation where you have to evacuate the city of New York could also be something you could do with this kind of attack. So companies that manage buildings like this have to think this way. And I would think that cities and counties and governments have to start legislating this kind of fallback mechanism.
Only if they have the money for the infrastructure. And unfortunately, we haven't put forth the money for infrastructure changes and updates in this country. That does need to be a priority.
That's true.
So it's not just the bridges falling down. It's also, is our power grid resilient to cyber attack?
All right. Let's go ahead and go with your ISP.
Yes.
This is a city doing something right, right?
Yes. municipal broadband. It's been a favorite topic for some time on this show. Here, we're going to take you to the wonderful city of Wilson, North Carolina. And they were giving users access through municipal broadband to have fast internet, faster than what the telcos were providing.
So the town, township, city, whatever, had broadband set up for their buildings, and they went ahead and added, and they allowed its citizens to start using it, I'm assuming for a fee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the state of North Carolina came back with a law saying that you are not allowed to compete with private interests.
So lobbyists for telcos came to the legislation of the state and said, hey, pass this law that helps us help customers better. And some money was exchanged. Assuming legal ways, campaign funds, and then they passed a law that made it illegal for the city to be a business that was a telco, so therefore turning off the broadband for its customers.
Right. This town then decided they're going to take a novel take on this, which was they're offering it for free, fiber to the home.
So they're not selling it anymore, which means they're not comparing
right.
as a business.
And they're hoping that they can talk some reason into legislators to change the state law that prevents them from selling internet services to non-residents.
They would like to get some funds, obviously,
right?
Because it would help subsidize the system.
Yeah, and they're going to do this for – it's a temporary fix. They're going to do this for about 6 months and hope that they can wait and have some time to do some convincing in that time. And it's a shame because it's already done. The fiber is there. It's hooked up. It's just a question of this crony capitalism.
A lot of these stories today have reminded me of this this story that I read from Bed Fountain from The Guardian. And the title of it is The Big Con, What is Really at Stake in This U.S. Election. And it's not about the current election. It's about the New Deal and what the United States did after the Great Depression to get us back
during
on our feet.
The Great Depression.
During the Great Depression to get us back on our feet. And it's just a wonderful 80-year discussion about what happened in the United States and why, for example, we have power everywhere. We don't have power everywhere because private companies decided to put power to farms. In fact, it was 30 years of electricity existing and farmers not having electricity because it wasn't cost-effective. It wasn't as cost-effective to run electrical lines to farms.
Right. Population density drops and it's just a lot more expensive to get out there.
And we see that with telcos as well. You cannot get good fiber connections outside of cities because it's financially not very viable. Inside cities, you kind of can. And so there's this great idea that our nation was, in a large sense, built up by corporations. But in reality, it was built up by government. And when
a mixture of the two, but yes.
But when people talk about, especially in areas where it's rural areas and clearly people are feeling like government is bad for them, the infrastructure that used to exist, the non-existent infrastructure that used to exist before government stepped in, is what we're moving back towards. Anyway, this article is about that. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. The reason why rural areas have telephones is because
– even power. Like I always knew telephones were kind of subsidies because we talked about as the breakup of the big bells and then the recombining of the big bells. We've talked about a lot on the show that the reason why they were able to run all these lines was because of the tax breaks they were given by government to actually do that. And of course – that those incentives were public decisions, incentives that created the infrastructure.
Right. And it was also this thought of if everyone has access to, for example, electricity or to telephones and like that, the net result ends up being a bettering of society. It wasn't a charity. It was this is an investment in the future of the nation.
And that's basically what the New Deal was and what socialism in this country is. And it turned into, especially with the fight of communism, it's turned into a bad word. And it's just interesting to see that right now and see what benefit people are getting from government or what benefit they have gotten from and what they're losing and the flow of that. So if you're interested in that, I'll link to that.
Right. And then the question of whether or not the internet follows that line and whether we should be making sure that everyone has access to a reasonable internet speed so that they can take part. So you don't have these islands of people that are cut off from information, from access.
Yeah. Well, that got pretty political, didn't it? Sorry about that. Nah. You don't mind, right?
Has nothing to do with the election. It's just general thoughts.
Yeah. Hey, tell me about Apple, because you have this headline here that says that Apple takes 100% of all smartphone profits. And because you've posted this here, I have to think that there's something here, because, of course, you can't have more than 100%. That's mathematically.
Yes, you can.
I know this, that's true, Miles, but I'm just trying to figure out how it possibly could be. And the reason I know it's true is I know you.
Because the Galaxy Note 7, the phone that was famous for catching on fire, had to be recalled. So that was a net loss on the industry, especially specifically on the part of Samsung. And so when you take in those losses and that negative result, Apple ends up with 104% of the market.
Very clever, sir. You win.
Which is impressive for a company that only has 12% of the market.
That's true. That is impressive. Well, since you brought up Apple, I'll talk about the new iPhone 7 Plus that I'm using now for about a week. This has the double camera, and I took some pictures of you before the show just to show what this auto blurring feature is like. And what they're doing, they have two cameras, and they're taking in the two cameras, and from those two angles, they're able to figure out the depth, and I think they splice the image into 7 fields of depth. And then with facial recognition, they know where your face is, the camera knows where your face is, and it looks where the face is, what depth field it's in. Then it makes a mask off of that depth field and blurs the rest of the picture based on how many depth fields away it is from the facial detection neutral point.
Yeah, to simulate a DSLR.
To simulate a DSLR, exactly. And it's not going to be perfect. A great example of this is if you put your hand on top of your head and you have a void in between your arm and your face, that void will also not be blurred. Because your elbow and your face are at the same field, they'll be in focus, but it's not good enough to understand that there's a void there that goes is a punch through. So you can create kind of odd images. It's like using Photoshop, not very well. But I've used it quite a few times, and I'm actually quite happy with the photos that come out of it, because you can't normally get that with these pinhole type cameras, because you just don't have an aperture wide enough to get a bokeh effect.
So what you're saying, the $1,000 phone with a camera is not as good as the $1,500 camera with a $2,000 lens.
Well, okay. First off, I think I've got more like a $600 camera, and my lens was probably $400 quite a while ago. And no, I mean, that camera takes much better pictures in some regards. Its low light capabilities are not as good as the iPhone. It's also not always with me, which means it takes a lot less pictures.
Right. The best camera is the one you have with you.
Yeah, in your pocket all the time. So anyway, I'm really happy with this fake bokeh type blur portrait mode thing. I think it's cool. I think it'll get better. I'm also pretty happy having the optical zoom. Now, they don't actually have an optical zoom on this thing. They just have two cameras I mentioned before. One's a more telephoto-y type lens than the wide-angle lens. It's cool to switch between the two. I was using it at a party last night, and in the dark, it was kind of fun. What's another thing that I... Oh, the button. The zombie button, the dead zombie button. The button on the iPhone 7 is not really a button. It's a thumbprint reader. And when you depress it...
It's a taptic, yeah.
Yeah, when you depress it, it gives a feedback, or vibrate. And it feels good enough... Not great, but it feels good enough. As I've used it, I recognize every once in a while that it's not right. And
so you're in the uncanny valley for buttons.
I'm so glad you came to that same conclusion. Exactly. It's the uncanny valley, of course, is the visual effect of seeing something that's humanoid, but not perfectly humanoid.
It's why zombies freak us out so much.
It's why zombies freak us out. They're not really human. And we accept things naturally really quickly. We're really good at... pareidolia of seeing faces and things, and when our systems keep on getting reassured that that is true, it feels comfortable. When our systems go, wait, there's actually something wrong, it becomes uncanny, and that's called the uncanny valley. That when something gets close enough to being really real but isn't exactly, we have an EB effect. If you saw the great example of that is animated movie, the something Express.
Oh, Polar Express?
Polar Express had that kind
of thing. Right. If something is totally animated where it looks nothing like realism, we're fine with it. If something is absolutely realistic, if we're looking at something like Avatar, you know, where the people are computer-generated but animated, and you go like, oh, I can accept that. It's when they're the crazy Tom Hanks train conductor, you're just, oh.
Something wrong. Anyway, so the button definitely feels that way. And I have to say that when you actually turn it off, and it doesn't work as a button anymore, it feels like you're touching a dead thing. And that's weird. anyway, so that's the iPhone 7 update. And I'll post a link to a little...
We press dead buttons.
We press dead buttons. That's a great title of the show. All right. And I feel like we had another story about Apple. Phil said something lovely, didn't he?
Yes.
Phil Schiller.
He was asked, why doesn't the MacBook Pro still have an SD card slot, especially if it were a micro SD slot?
Yep.
Because SD adapters are, you know, they come with the micro SD cards now. They're so cheap.
Sure.
And a micro SD would totally fit into the profile of the new laptops.
A normal SD card reader would as well.
Yes. But let's, you know... Let's take the bit
No. I've got friggin' audio recorder that is an SD card, not a mini. Oh, you're saying that could then get minis and put them inside the SD? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
If you got a micro SD port on the laptop, then getting an adapter that fits into a standard SD on your camera would be not a problem.
Then you'd get the SD wrapper where the micro would be inside of your SD card. Right. So you had an SD card in your camera. You pull the SD card out. You pull out the micro card. Then you stick it in your computer and all is well in the world.
Right.
I grant you that that's perfect scenario. Why didn't – what does he say? What does Phil say when he was asked this question?
I will do a quote, direct quote here because of a couple of things. One, it's a bit of a cumbersome slot. I disagree with that, but okay. What's cumbersome is when you're having to plug in a thumb drive, those things sticking out 2 or 3 inches off of the side. That's cumbersome. You got this thing sticking halfway out. Yeah, like I said, there are very fine and fast USB card readers, and then you can use compact flash as well as SD. I want someone to call in and say, do you honestly use compact flash as often as SD? Because SD, let's be honest, SD, micro SD, SD, that's one. Compact flash is not anywhere near the popularity, the ubiquity.
No.
In the camera space, in the peripheral space.
The newer, I mean, my camera that I mentioned earlier, the Nikon I've got, I don't know, I've had it for 4 years and it has an SD card in it. Like, flash has gone away. SD cards are definitely away.
So we can never really resolve this. We picked SD because more customer cameras have SD, but you can only pick one. So that's a bit of a trade-off. Yeah, everything's a trade-off. So
except
is choosing.
That he hasn't actually addressed about removing it, because the problem is the new laptops do not have this card slot.
And then says, and then more and more cameras are starting to build wireless transfer into the camera. That's proving useful. So I think the path forward is where you can use a physical adapter if you want, or do wireless transfer. Okay.
What's the problem with that, Miles?
Remember we were talking about Internet of Things and how security wasn't quite worked out for the random things that were...
Yes, you're right.
How are you pairing things correctly? Does the camera do Wi-Fi through Bluetooth? Does it do Wi-Fi as in like 2.4 gigahertz? What happens if you have a 5 gigahertz network? Like, why wireless is not...
No, it's not. It's not a good solution because of the network problem. Like, my camera doesn't have Wi-Fi. I would like it to have Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
but the truth is, I have friends that have Wi-Fi cameras, and they're not actually as useful as you'd think, because the cameras are taking a lot of pictures, and sometimes there's videos, and you don't want to be in the situation where you're just using battery for no reason. Like, that's the thing, is that it takes a lot of energy to do wireless.
Yeah, and... Then there's the whole issue of what happens if you have a camera like yours that doesn't have wireless? Then you get an SD card that is wireless built into it, but then you're limited by buying this thing that probably doesn't have the same storage space.
Is clearly peripheral. You will get a little dongle that will stick your SD card in, and you'll connect it to your computer. Right. I mean, I've got one for my iPhone and iPad so that I can actually pull images in, right? That's a common thing.
And I understand they're stuck for space, but I have a micro SD card right in my hand right now that I'm holding up for emphasis.
So it's not,
and it's smaller than my thumbnail, and I keep my nails trimmed.
Okay, I of course absolutely would love it if they put the SD card. I'm not justifying, but the size of that card is not all it's about, right? It also means another opening in the machine. The SD card slot needs to be waterproof because. Why not? I mean, there's other reasons.
Whoa! There is no waterproofing with the MacBook Pro.
That's true.
That's No. Those USB-C slots are not waterproof. The top of the laptop with the keyboard has spaces between the keys, and there's a reason why it's an open space, because that's part of the thermal venting. that argument does not hold water for me.
All right. Hold water.
See what I did there?
Yeah, very clever. All right. Why don't we go with DeepMind?
So we have covered how AI has been playing chess, and IBM's Watson takes on grandmasters in chess and beats them now consistently.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. How they've been working on getting it so that it can beat a Go grand champion, and they're not all the way there, but they're getting there.
Yeah,
it's within shooting distance. Well, it turns out that StarCraft II is more complicated from an AI standpoint than either chess or Go.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah, and at first you think like, wait, but chess is so complicated and Go is so complicated. But then, no, there are a lot of moving parts in StarCraft II.
Oh, yeah. So StarCraft II is a real-time strategy game. It's one of those things where you have to build stuff and then kill people. So these strategy games, of course, as you improve your civilization, it can produce more abilities. And... of course, everything in the game has multiple levels of armor and of weaponry. And deciding where you're going to spend your resources is all about what tactics you will be doing later. You could get a lot really good defensive and move slowly across the game, or you go really fast attacking.
Yeah. Or you can attack really quick with a lot of cheap units, or you can use those money and resources to get better technology to fight better. But if you're doing that, you don't have as many troops to start off with. It's a real...
And people can attack you.
It's basically warfare simulation.
Yeah, sure.
And I love this poll quote from VentureBeat. So I just want to give a shout out to them for Google and Blizzard are opening up StarCraft 2 to anyone who wants to teach artificial intelligence systems how to conduct warfare. Because apparently I'm the only one who has ever seen the Terminator.
Yeah. See this? Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah.
Kudos, Jeff Grubb. That is a great quote. Thank you so much.
So artificial intelligence getting good at warfare does not have to have a side effect of having machines kill off humans by their own accord. Because if you get a system that's really good at warfare and it's better than humans, then humans will put that system in charge of warfare because then you'll win the war.
Right.
So the U.S. government at some point will decide to do this kind of thing. And that means that suggestions of movement of troops might not be comprehensible by humans. That could happen in our lifetime.
Yep. Easily in our lifetime. We're not talking that far off.
It's not already happening now.
Yeah, we're not that far off.
Well, of course, the reason why Google's saying this is more complex is that obviously it's more complex, right? And having highly intelligent actors at every level is really important for almost every complex thing you do because reassessment all the time is important. At the same time, warfare, it's really regular for a general to understand what they're doing and having the peons not, because sometimes a sacrificial move is necessary, right? So
So here's a question, though. What are the ethics of an AI system conducting warfare where they are killing the enemy more efficiently?
You know, when you talk about warfare.
But what happens if you have that same AI system is less prone to collateral damage?
Right. You mean.
Sorry, I hate using that euphemism, collateral damage.
Murdering
less prone
innocent.
To murdering innocent people who are not actively at war.
The ethics of warfare is something that's very challenging to really comprehend because you can justify nuclear warfare. And that's insane.
Yes. you listened to that episode that I told you about,
which episode?
Hardcore History.
No, I don't think I've listened to that. But I have listened to a lot of Hardcore History, not anything about nuclear warfare. But maybe it was the episode about World War II, they're dropping the bombs.
Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, the episode Logical Insanity. It's a great listen. I highly recommend it.
And one of the themes he talks about is the firebombing of different cities and the horror that exists across the firebombing of cities. And when you're talking about firebombing, you're talking about traditional warfare firebombing where you just have giant gasoline-type incendiary devices that hit a city. And it devastates lots of cities. And as you're using it, every day you're using it, thousands and thousands of people are dying. More of your troops die because the planes get shot down. You have to use a lot more weaponry. And everybody that's in that city is being tortured psychologically the entire time, which is, of course—
Oh, not just psychologically, but yeah.
Well, physically, but also psychologically. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not physically damaged, the fear of it in that is a psychological torture. And that, of course, is something you want to lessen in a good society.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do that and you do that over months compared to dropping a nuclear warhead and killing everybody in the city or mutilating and torturing and all that, you could justify the nuclear warhead as being a more ethical thing to do. And that's why playing this game
nuclear warheads are nuclear weapons are insane, and that's where that title came from, Logical Insanity.
Yeah, so when you talk about an AI taking over and therefore it being, less death occurs because of it, well, of course you do that. But if you have an artificial intelligence doing something that people do not understand, and that's already happening, right? This is not my soapbox on this, is that the systems that control our world, people do not understand completely, even though they wrote them. It's a hard thing to talk about ethics when you talk about that because at some level I start hearkening to Dune. Dune, the wonderful Frank Herbert series of Dune. In that Dune world, not everybody remembers this, but one of the major storylines of Dune is that they do not accept thinking machines. They are completely unacceptable. Not even calculators are acceptable in their society because at some – do you remember that?
Yeah, the Butlerian Jihad. Yeah.
Not only do you remember that plot line, you know the name of it. You're awesome.
Yeah, which brought forth the Orange Catholic Bible, which is their reason.
And the general idea of it, sometime in the past, this jihad happened where machines started fighting humans or killing humans or some bad thing happened. They don't actually get, Frank Herbert doesn't actually get into the details of it. I don't recall.
Right.
But a bad cataclysm event happened where you had to structure society where you never brought computers into thinking again.
Right. And so it was also the effects on humanity that humanity started becoming lazy and ill-prepared to manage itself.
And so in that society, the way you solve that is you give people drugs to enhance their intellectual capabilities.
Or for the Mentat, yeah. Or you breed them. You selectively breed human beings over thousands of years, yeah.
Man, what happened on that one?
So speaking of we don't understand the systems, that goes right very well into Google's other AI, which was they took two systems running an AI and through passing messages – between each other repeatedly and improving the system, and like they were able to create their own form of encryption.
Oh yeah, we didn't cover this last week. Oh no, great, because we didn't do a show last week. It was re-recorded.
Yeah, that was. Yes. That is not.
I remember that story. That was great. Okay, so what you're saying is they took three players. They took two AIs that were trying to communicate with each other, and they took a third AI and they let the third AI listen to the communication between the two. And the first two they gave a secret to. That both of them had. So it was a very simple – it was simple in the sense that if you have a scenario like that, it's relatively easy for us to do this kind of encryption. It's not a complex problem.
And the message, message is only 16 bits long. So
right. And these AIs were learning machines, right, similar to neural net systems, right?
Yeah.
So the positive feedback for the sending machine was the – negative the message scrambled capability, the output of the spy. So the spy's output, the first system would look at that output, and if it had no relation to what it was sending, it knew it was good, and that was its feedback loop. And the spying machine, if you will, was looking at its output compared to A's sending data as its feedback system. It couldn't actually look at A's sending data without encrypted. And that was it. That was the simplicity of it. Oh, and then the third machine had to, you know, see if it had how close its output was to the original message. And because those two AIs had a secret, they were able to produce an effective algorithm that did encryption, which is really cool.
Right. Or rather, they were able to produce one. They don't know how effective it is. They produced it and the researchers don't know what all is involved in it. It's that whole black box again.
Okay, that's the thing that's creepy.
Right. And so it may be that it has some major flaws in it, that if cryptographic researchers took a look at it, they'd be able to, you know, cut the key length down dramatically.
But the interesting thing is that we don't actually know how they did it.
Right. Well,
not yet.
Yeah, we don't know the process for how they got there. Right.
Yeah, which is really, really, really cool. Tell me about another complicated system. Let's talk about planetary environment.
So there is still an ongoing debate in the U.S. as to whether global warming is real or not. And you have on
That's
one
not
side
a
climate
debate.
Scientists. I'm not saying that one side is rational in their denial. I'm just saying there is a debate. And people have been talking about climate scientists have been talking about how sea levels will rise. And so we wonder, like, okay, if sea levels are going to rise by how much they say, that's going to be a major problem, right?
Right.
And so that comes the other side. The skeptics may come up and say, like, well, maybe it isn't going to be as high as – maybe that's just doomsday. Well, it turns out some NASA scientists have been looking at the data. So they've been looking at their models and then looking at data as it comes to pass.
You mean actual sea levels?
Right. Based upon, you know, we saw this actual amount of temperature rise. And so we expected to see with our models this level of sea level rise.
Uh-huh.
Turns out they were underestimating the rise.
Oh, no. By what percentage?
Anywhere between 5 and 28%. So not just a little off. Way off, and way off in the wrong direction for
if you like land.
Yes, if you like land,
and us mammals seem to like it quite a bit.
If you live in Florida, this is bad news. If you live in Louisiana, this is very bad news.
You know what's amazing is that the housing market in those areas hasn't crashed, because when you're talking about housing, you're talking about like a 30-year investment. Don't buy a house. But you expect it to not be underwater in 30 years if you're really low.
Unless you expect there to be levies and stuff like that. I mean, if you look at Holland, you're talking about you build up a huge, you know, system of dikes, and you just hold back the ocean. Now, at the same time, Florida is a much longer coastline.
It's a long coastline to figure out. Yeah, and also, you know, when you're talking about average sea level, anyone that's near an ocean understands swells and storms. The ocean deviates quite a bit, not just the tidals, but also the storm.
Right,
swell.
The storm surge. Yeah,
you really get a lot of variation. So kind of scary. And you know, even for our hometown, our little town of Santa Cruz that they were, you know, fond of, that's going to be a serious problem. 5 to 28% incorrect in their models, and their models were already devastating within 50 years.
Underestimated by 5 to 28%.
That's depressing. I was curious about the space news just because Ben's not around, and I haven't heard a good Black Bear story.
Yeah. Black holes. Did you know they move?
I know that they can orbit things. I know they spin.
Well, as it turns out, there is a black hole that is referred to as a naked black hole, meaning that it has already consumed its stellar companions. And millions of years ago, it was just an ordinary supermassive black hole. So supermassive black hole, meaning it's not just a single large star collapse. This is a whole lot of, you know, anywhere between thousands to millions of stellar masses or billions of stellar masses.
A stellar mass is the mass of our sun.
Yeah. Or a typical star, yeah.
And, no, one solar mass is Sol, our sun.
Oh, it is? That's how they refer to it?
That's how they refer to it.
Okay. Well, it devoured all of the surrounding stars and stuff. So now it's just this naked black hole, so it's really hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going through space at 2,000 kilometers per second.
Is it heading this way?
No.
Also, would it matter? No.
No. because it is in a distant galaxy. So if it were in our own galaxy, it probably wouldn't be an issue.
Relativistic speeds in other galaxy doesn't make sense. Compared to its galaxy, it is traveling that speed? Because galaxies travel at different speeds to each other, so who cares that it's traveling that fast? You know what I'm saying? Anyway.
Sure.
It's moving.
But the troubles began when its galaxy came in close proximity to another galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of just hanging out in its own galaxy, it got slingshot off.
Oh, it consumed and moved.
Yep.
So it left its two galaxies that were forming it.
Right. And that's what makes it naked. That's what makes it. It's off on its own.
The naked black hole is screaming ready through the universe.
Yeah, ready to.
That's a great title.
Ready to cause all sorts of problems. And which does make me want to say, I've plugged it before, but if you haven't seen PBS's Space Time yet,
you always
watch that.
It is awesome.
Yes, it's awesome. And people need to watch it because it's candy for the brain.
Candy for the brain.
Yeah. It's candy that it's also whole wheat. Like, it's really nourishing, but it's just so mind-bending. It's exercise. So is that it? Chrome is now 50%. There's a new browser that I'm using as my primary browser.
What browser are you using?
Brave.
Why are you using Brave? And wait, Chrome's what? 50% what?
Of all browser traffic, Internet Explorer and Microsoft Edge. So a Microsoft browser is no longer the majority. Most traffic is now coming through people using Google Chrome. And I have stopped using Google Chrome on my phone
On
my tablet. And I haven't quite made the switch on my desktop yet to the Brave browser.
What is that?
It's the browser that automatically blocks ads and tracking on a website. Which is especially useful when you're on mobile because all of those ads take up most of the screen.
Sure.
It does a really good job of actually giving you content. But what's different about this one from just, say, using Firefox and Adblock is that it also has an interface for paying sites directly. So you can have a list of sites and you can say, I want to give some money to them as a way for you to offset the ad revenue that they may lose.
That's cool. Are you paying?
I have not yet. I've only just made the switch over.
Yeah.
But it did make me think of, how do I get geeksweek.org to be able to have this feature?
Awesome.
Get somebody kicked out through there. That would be awesome. That would be seamless and frictionless.
Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff, reuse our stuff any way you'd like. You can make money on it. Just let them know that we made it. I want to thank Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, StarCraft Bots Profit from Archived Racism. I want to thank also Michael Newman of FetStar Music, who provided our theme song, and thank you for being here for episode 46 of our season 16. Miles, thank you for joining me on air once again.
Always a pleasure.